From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the search area for wreckage from the Air Asia jet is expanded. Civilians flee fighting between Indian and Pakistani troops in Kashmir.
I think one has to recognize that over the last 7 or 8 months since the Modi government has come into power, tensions have heightened rather than reduced.
And we hear how the U.S. poet laureate Charles Wright is inspired by China's Tang Dynasty poets. It's all ahead. I'm Sarah Williams. An international team of rescue vessels took advantage of improved weather today to try to pinpoint wreckage from Air Asia Flight 8501 that crashed into the Java Sea on December 28th. As Ron Corbin reports for VOA from Bangkok, the stepped-up search comes as Indonesian authorities have announced an audit into the nation's airline industry.
Divers from Russia and Singapore joined other search vessels in desperate efforts to reach the jet's wreckage, believed to have broken up in four pieces, which have been caught in swirling monsoon tides. The head of Indonesia's search and rescue agency, Henry Bambang Solyustyo, told a news conference Tuesday the search had been widened in the recovery of debris and bodies.
Hari ini akan dilakukan tambahan.
Solyustyo said, along with a wider search area, better weather conditions led to deployment of underwater search devices along with the dive teams. Air Asia Flight 8501 crashed midway through a scheduled service from the Indonesian city of Surabaya to Singapore after encountering heavy storms with 162 passengers and crew on board. Rescuers hoped that many could still be in the plane's fuselage, making it possible to recover their bodies. So far, just over three dozen bodies have been recovered, one third of them positively identified. Indonesian forensic scientists are working with teams from Australia, Malaysia, and the United Arab Emirates. Prayers by both Muslim and Christian communities have also been offered. Many on the flight came from Surabaya's Christian minority. The international rescue effort has brought together teams from over half a dozen nations using 20 planes and helicopters along with more than 25 vessels. On Tuesday, China dispatched a naval vessel and aircraft to the search area. Other nations taking part include Indonesia, South Korea, Japan, Malaysia, Singapore and the United States. The U.S. naval vessels involved in the effort are the 7th Fleet destroyer USS Sampson and USS Fort Worth, as well as a resupply vessel. U.S. Navy Deputy Public Affairs Officer Loren Cole says the international cooperation in the search effort has been at a high level.
Whenever there's a tragedy, whenever there is some sort of crisis that requires response, it's really amazing to see all of the countries pull together and assist with whatever needs to be done. In this case, the Indonesians have done a truly tremendous job in conducting and organizing this entire multinational search effort.
While the intensive search goes on, Indonesia's acting Director General of Air Transportation, Joko Murtomoto, has launched an audit and investigation into the nation's airline industry. Air Asia's Indonesia offshoot is already being investigated for not having official permits to operate its flight to Singapore on Sundays. The ministry has also ordered the suspension of the Surabaya airport operator and control tower officials. Hugh Ritchie, Chief Executive Officer of Australian-based Aviation Consultants International, says the crackdown comes against concerns over Indonesia's air safety.
The observatory's Rami.
A senior figure from the self-declared police force of the Islamic State has been beheaded in a Syrian province, a Britain-based monitoring group said today. Meanwhile, as Salah Hennessy reports for VOA from London, the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights also says Kurdish forces may be on the verge of recapturing a key border town from Islamic State militants.
The observatory's Rami Abdurrahman says the man, known as a senior IS police official, was found in the eastern Syrian province Deir al-Zor. He says the body displayed signs of torture and was found with a cigarette in the mouth. Abdurrahman says it's not clear who killed him. The observatory also reports that two Islamic State militants were attacked by unknown assailants in the Deir al-Zor city of Al-Mayadeen. The death and attacks come a day after Kurdish forces made major gains in the Syrian border town Kobani. Abdurrahman says fighting was ongoing Tuesday, with IS militants continuing to lose control.
They are losing again some building and some road in the southeast of the security square.
Kobani is a strategically important town on the border between Turkey and Syria, which IS fighters first attacked in September. But with support from U.S.-led airstrikes and reinforced by Kurds from Iraq, according to Abdurrahman, Kurdish fighters have taken back around 80% of the area.
Next few days, if they continue like what happened yesterday, could be that Kobani will be out of ISIS control.
Middle East expert Michael Stevens of London's Royal United Services Institute says Kobani will most likely be won back by the Kurds, but he says the Islamic State may be putting its focus elsewhere.
I think ISIS has realized that it's just not worth expending that much resources on anymore. They're a bigger fish to fry. So they've concentrated their attacks in other areas where I think they have more strategic or logistical importance than a small town on the border with Turkey.
But he says the town has become an important symbol of resistance against the Islamic State, and in that respect, this is an important victory.
There is a sort of sense that the tide is turning, that ISIS are beginning to feel the pinch, but, you know, the real core operational heartlands of the Islamic State have yet to be affected. And I think until that happens, we really can't say that this is going well.
All the same, he adds, the anti-IS push is going better than it was 6 months ago. Selah Hennessy for VOA News, London.
Thousands of Indians have reportedly fled their homes as fighting between Indian and Pakistani border troops in the contested Kashmir region spreads. Reuters says some 6,000 civilians in Indian-controlled Kashmir fled their homes as of late Monday, with at least 10 soldiers and civilians killed in the past week. India and Pakistan have intermittently exchanged fire across the working boundary during the past months in violation of a mutual 2003 ceasefire, though both sides accused each other of firing the first shot. Tensions between the two nuclear-armed South Asian rivals rose after Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi called off peace talks in August. In Washington, a U.S. spokesperson expressed concern and urged both sides to engage in a dialogue to ease tensions. Rafiq Dosani, a South Asia analyst at the RAND Corporation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the reports of fighting and casualties are coming from the militaries of both countries and should be viewed skeptically.
Probably the case that both sides are exaggerating what's happening. I think one has to recognize that over the last 7 or 8 months since the Modi government has come into power, tensions have heightened rather than reduced. And that's really the disappointing outcome that one can take away from this repeated cycle of attacks. I mean, this is not the first one. There was 3 months ago a much larger one where the Indian government claimed that about 25,000 people had to flee their homes. So it's disappointing that the situation has reached this level. And I think that's probably something that the U.S. needs to be very worried about.
Is there a change in policy under Prime Minister Modi?
It's not clear, because he started off with a very positive approach towards Pakistan and then, on what appears to have been a whim, decided to make things more hardline and hostile. It's not clear whether he's playing to his own domestic constituents, particular components of them such as the RSS, or whether this is under genuine provocation from Pakistan. I mean, it's all speculation at this point. But the reality is something has taken a turn for the worse, and compared with pretty uncertain, volatile, and not generally good relations, say, under the previous government of the Congress Party, it's become become much worse now.
According to the Associated Press, India says Pakistani troops committed more than 550 violations of a ceasefire last year, the most since the two nations signed the accord back in 2003. Obviously, there's been an uptick in violence. Who's the aggressor here?
We really don't know whether it's 550 or 55 or even 5.5. And Pakistan can also claim what it likes. And no one should believe them because the history on both sides is of massively lying to suit their short-term political goals. So there's absolutely no credibility one can give other than this repeated reports on both sides indicates that there is a worsening of relationships. Whether that's actually accompanied by much more severe violence and what's behind that is something entirely speculative. To the extent that it's true, my sense is it signals what I was saying earlier, a worsening of relationships between the two countries and something that, as I said, the United States and others should be extremely worried about given the nuclear status of both countries.
Apparently, Secretary of State John Kerry and President Obama will visit India later this month.
Yes, the 26th of January is India's Republic Day, and President Obama is going to be the chief guest. It's hard to see this being linked with that. I think India has reasons to try and keep things under control, at least till Obama visits. And Pakistan, which has just received a large amount of aid from cleared by the United States, also has no reason to particularly provoke Obama at this time.
That's Rafiq Dosani of the RAND Corporation. As U.S. lawmakers return to Washington for the brand new 114th Congress, Republicans likely will exert greater influence after winning control of the Senate and boosting their majority in the House of Representatives. VOA's Cindy Sain looks at what this will mean for President Barack Obama and for Washington's ability to deal with pressing issues such as immigration and economic inequality.
After a Christmas vacation with his family in Hawaii, President Obama returned to Washington to face a stark new political reality. Incoming Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told CNN's State of the Union that the Senate will vote on a lot of things the president is not going to like, such as a proposed oil pipeline and energy deregulation. McConnell said the balance of power has shifted.
Now he needs to talk to us, and that's good, because when the American people elect divided government, they're not saying they don't want anything done. What they are saying is they want things done in the political center.
One of the new Republican members of Congress, Mia Love, says lawmakers need to pay more attention to voters.
You know, we have faced dysfunction because people on both sides of the aisle have said, you know, we want Americans to trust us again, and we've got that backwards. We have to trust the American people again.
On the Democratic side of the aisle, Senator Elizabeth Warren strongly disagrees with the Republican agenda, saying Congress needs to focus on the nation's disadvantaged.
Washington already works really well for the billionaires and the big corporations and the lawyers and the lobbyists. But what about the families who lost their homes or their jobs or their retirement savings the last time Citi bet big on derivatives and lost? We were sent here to fight for those families. And it is time, it is past time for Washington to start working for them.
Analyst Stuart Rothenberg says Warren represents a growing populist wing within the Democratic Party.
The populist, anti-establishment, Democratic progressive left is developing supporters of Senator Elizabeth Warren, Mayor de Blasio from New York, the movement that wants to talk more about equality and fairness, $15, $20 minimum wage. That is a growing force within the Democratic Party.
But on issues such as immigration, Rothenberg says Republicans are more divided than Democrats.
So in that regard, the Republicans are more divided. The Republicans are more intimidated at the moment by their most ideological wing, the Tea Party folks. And so they probably have somewhat more blame for the paralysis.
As expert crews work on restoring the beautiful dome on the outside of the U.S. Capitol, some analysts say lawmakers on the inside also have plenty of work to do to restore trust and find common ground. Cindy Sain, VOA News, on Capitol Hill.
The International Organization for Migration is calling for action to stop the use of so-called ghost ships to transport migrants across the Mediterranean Sea to Europe. The IOM says it fears many migrants will lose their lives if this risky practice is allowed to continue. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from IOM headquarters in Geneva.
Over the past week, more than 1,000 migrants, most fleeing conflict in Syria, had to be rescued in the Mediterranean Sea. Survivors of the two so-called ghost ships in which they were traveling say the crews aboard abandoned their ships using lifeboats after locking in the automatic pilot as the boats neared the Italian coastline. Both could have capsized with heavy loss of life, but the migrants were lucky. The first boat, carrying 736 people, made it to shore in southern Italy on New Year's Eve. The second, with 359 Syrian refugees on board, was abandoned by its crew and was towed ashore over the weekend by the European Union's Triton mission. Triton is a scaled-down version of Italy's Mare Nostrum, which rescued tens of thousands of migrants at sea before the mission was shut down at the end of October. A spokesman for the International Organization for Migration, Joel Millman, says rescued passengers reported paying between $4,000 and $8,000 to smugglers based in Turkey, which is where the voyages originated.
Obviously, we look upon this with alarm. We're concerned that with Mare Nostrum now ended and the migrations continuing at pretty high numbers through the winter in very dangerous conditions, that this may be something we're going to be seeing more of in the weeks ahead.
Italian authorities report 163,368 migrants were rescued at sea through the first 11 months of 2014. This is about three times the total arriving in 2013. They say Syrians were the most numerous migrants, followed by Eritreans. IOM reports more than 3,000 migrants went missing on the Mediterranean last year, presumed drowned. It says they were crossing from North Africa when their small, unsafe boat sank or capsized. Migrants describe the so-called ghost ships as large cargo vessels, which, despite their size, are old and unsafe. Maritime experts figure such ships can be bought for between $100,000 and $150,000. At this rate, the IOM calculates that smugglers can earn more than $3 million for voyages like the two that ended in recent days, with up to 900 migrants crammed on board. And with the ships on autopilot near the coast, the smugglers greatly reduce the chance of getting caught by EU or Italian authorities. Millman says thousands of Syrians are fleeing every month, so smugglers can plan on a reliable stream of customers. He notes Lebanon's recent decision to require visas from Syrians wishing to enter the country is likely to swell the demand for smuggler services in Turkey. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
The U.S. Poet Laureate is often described as the public face of American poetry. Tennessee-born Charles Wright is the current Poet Laureate. VOA's Adam Phillips interviewed Charles Wright recently in New York and found him to be both mystical and earthy.
Despite his international renown as one of the most acute, prolific, and talented American poets of his generation, grandstanding is not Charles Wright's style. Indeed, Wright believes that poetry itself may be dying out as a serious and relevant art form, at least in the West.
It's going. We all know that. Because there's no real reason for it anymore, except that some people really like it. I mean, it doesn't tell the stories, it doesn't tell the story of the tribe, it doesn't do all that stuff it used to do. You know, those of us who get caught up in it for whatever reason and continue to do it, it's a blessing. And those who don't have anything to do with it, I guess that's a blessing for them. I don't know.
Wright has written poems on the landscapes with which he has become intimately familiar over the course of his 79 years. From the American South, where he was born and raised and lived much of his adult life, to Italy, where he also made a home, to the Rocky Mountains of Montana. Along the way, he's tackled universal themes such as love, spirituality, mortality, and art. He says he's finally lost the desperate urge to write that he felt as a younger man, and that that's okay. Wright's poem, Waterfalls, seems to hint at this.
Waterfalls. When is it we come to the realization that all things are wandering away? Is it age? Is it lack of adoration? Is it regret that there's no ladder to the clouds? Whatever, we inhabit the quotidian as we must, while somewhere behind our backs, waterfalls tumble and keep on going into the deep desire of distance.
What does that mean, the deep desire of distance? It's so sort of, it's sort of almost like a code.
Our desire is always at a certain distance from us, I think, or we should keep it a certain distance from us, otherwise it will overcome us and we'll drown in it.
Still, Wright has found what he calls a spiritual connection with China's Tang Dynasty poets, who lived between the 7th century and the early 10th century.
Because they always wrote about the landscape. They were always part of the landscape. They were always writing about what it meant to them. They didn't try to get behind it. They just tried to describe it, you know. But by describing it minutely and perfectly, you get behind it, whatever it is.
Here he reads a poem about the Tang Dynasty poet Han Shan, whose name means cold mountain, after the mountain where he also lived.
Cold mountain and cold mountain became the same thing in the mind, the first last seen slipping into a crevice in the second. Only the poems remain, scrawled on the rocks and trees. Nothing's undoing among the self-stung unfolding of things.
Poetry can seem opaque to those unfamiliar with its witchy charms and difficult truths. But unlike Poets Laureate of the past, Wright does not see himself as an activist for poetry per se. He does not want to, in his words, sit around and laureate. But Wright does have empathy for those who want to test the waters.
That's tough, you know, because you have to have a certain mindset. It's not like the newspaper. It's got to hit you. You can't go out and manufacture that. You've got to read something, usually something that's beautiful. You say, oh, wow, that's terrific, you know. But if it's a hardship on you, then don't do it. Read something else. It's okay if you don't like poetry. You can still go to heaven if you don't. You get there quicker if you do.
As if to continue, Wright reads from his poem, Ancient of Days.
This is an old man's poetry, written by someone who spent his life looking for one truth. Sorry, pal, there isn't one. Unless, of course, the trees and their blow-down relatives are part of it. Unless the late evening armada of clouds spanished along the horizon are part of it. Unless the diminishing pinprick of light stunned in the dark forest is part of it. Unless, oh my, whatever the eye makes out and sends on its rough road trace to the heart is part of it, then maybe that bright vanishing might be.
Charles Wright is the 20th United States Poet Laureate Consultant in Poetry. His most recent collection, Caribou, was published in 2014.
I'm here for you. Maybe you love yourself like me.